Welcome to God in Film, the podcast where a Christian and an atheist dive into the best that cinema has to offer and see if we can find any parallels with gospel or any other Bible stories. I'm educator and lonely centurion, Giles Goff.
And I'm librarian and 10th level paladin, Julia Hall.
And today we'll be looking at season 2 of The Chosen, the first multi-season retelling of the life of Jesus and the people he chose to follow him. And you are in for a treat today, ladies and gents, because for this episode, we're joined by yet another co-host of such lethal cunning.
Hello, I'm podcaster and twisted fire starter, Louisa Jane Smith.
That's a fantastic introduction.
And as you might have heard, there is another voice here, ladies and gents. We have a simple rule on the God in Film podcast, and it is basically that Claire is the only one who actually permits me to do this podcast, and as a result, we let her do pretty much whatever she damn well pleases.
So when I want to gatecrash, I just gatecrash.
How are you doing, sweetheart?
I'm doing good, thanks, baby. How are you doing?
Stop flirting with me. We do have yet another person making his debut on the episode. Cassidy Goff is currently asleep in his mother's arms. So if you hear any weird noises, well, to be honest, if you hear any weird noises, it's probably Julia, but just in case it's not, it's our second born.
That'd be Cassidy.
So let's start off with Julia, because I think Louisa, I think you've already seen this show. Are you already familiar with it?
Yes, I have.
And Julia, this is yet another one of the things that I forced you to watch. What did you think?
I really liked it. I think some aspects in some episodes I liked more than others. I think I much preferred the in-depth look at sort of the disciples and their kind of their lives rather than... And Jesus is great. Jesus is so good in this. But sometimes the more kind of Jesus teaching, I did multitask during those. But my crochet now, you know, has so many Jesus sermons in it that, you know, I feel like that makes it even more special.
Holy crochet.
So Jesus not really doing it for you, but the disciples very much so.
Yeah. Some of the lengthier teaching and some of the lengthier Jesus kind of providing counsel, I will admit it, I did switch off a tiny bit, but looking at the disciples' lives, especially how Matthew obviously goes from this base, I feel like the equivalent of a modern day like traffic warden. I think when you think of like who's a government official that you hate. Traffic wardens, I think, usually at least are the non-named government officials that we don't like.
Well, you're talking usually to sort of two teachers here. So Ofsted is usually the main eight figures. Yeah. Oh yeah, Louise is waking up now.
Yeah. We just said the O word. Woo! Triggering.
Yeah, you can't say it three times in quick succession.
Nope. Nope.
Otherwise, they will appear and grade you as unsatisfactory. You know. Louisa, I think you were already familiar with this show.
Yeah, it's interesting. I watched the first one, and I'm one of those people. I'm like, come on, impress me, just try, you know. And I kind of didn't want to like it, and I found it took me about one episode to get into it, and then I loved it. I loved the, you know, these are stories that I've grown up with. These are stories that I'm so familiar with. But what it did is put it into Technicolor. It just filled in those gaps. It put it in the context. Mm. And it made you think about things that you'd never thought about before, in that what would that actually look like if that was happening, that he healed everybody in one day, or, you know, that Matthew was a tax collector, and what was his personality like? And you've got, you know, the one that's the bit violent, and you've got the characters, and you've got, and Jesus is incredible, and how he builds relationships with people but has his boundaries. Yeah. You know, it is just, it's the most, I think, authentic depiction of how I understand the Gospels that I've ever seen.
Mm. And I think especially because it's such a different culture, sometimes it really helps to see it portrayed. Whereas reading about it, you can't always grasp it. I think for us, it's just the novelty of having some Christian media that's actually well made.
Yes.
Something that doesn't suck.
Yes.
Because people had recommended The Chosen to us before, people from church. And they say, are you doing The Chosen? I'm like, I've never heard of this.
Yeah.
And if you're recommending it, that's not a great sign.
Yeah.
People are always like, oh, you should watch this film or watch this show. And you watch it and you're like, oh, yeah. I'm going to shrivel up and die because it's so bad.
As someone who's not religious, that I can say that it stands up. I'm not saying it's a good piece of religious programming. It's a good piece of programming. You know, it's exceptional in terms of its faithfulness to the Bible. You know, its cinematography, its, you know, attention to detail, the acting, the direct, you know, absolutely everything about it is really, really high quality.
Definitely. Now it's time for Julia Facts.
Yay! I have a couple that I've picked out especially. So did you know that The Chosen is actually the largest crowdfunded media project of all time? So they rely entirely on basically like Kickstart equivalent. So that's donations by fans basically that allow them to make the show, hence why it's available for free, which I really appreciated, because while the first season is on Netflix, only the first season was on Netflix, but I was able to actually go to Angel Studios' website and watch the rest of it for free, which I think is important, especially if you're trying to tell this story, you want as many people to be able to access it as possible, right?
Yeah, no, and do you know what I think is interesting as well is the way that impacts on the producer's relationship with their fans. So the main guy who runs it, Dallas Jenkins, he's got a family background in making Christian media. His dad, I think, produced the Left Behind series. And what I was thinking about was he really struck me as a fascinating example of Christian leadership. We've been paying attention a lot to some absolutely horrendous Christian leaders at the moment. There's the scandal being uncovered with Mike Pilavachi and Soul Survivor. We were late to the dance on watching the Hillsong documentary, but we watched that. And that just seeing the way people, they get sort of elevated in leadership and then it just kind of throws them down. Seeing somebody who is basically the head of a production company acting almost like a faith leader, I thought was fascinating. You know, he's really, like, for example, season 4 is late coming out, so he produces a 16-minute video talking to his fans and explaining why it's late coming out and why and all the rest of it, which is fascinating, because again, most of the time, like, if you're Russell T. Davis, he's like, yeah, I'm doing what I want. I don't care. Shut up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I loved the way he... There was some fury at some point because there'd been a behind-the-scenes video where one member of the crew had a pride flag somewhere, and the scary American evangelical Christian right types had absolutely kicked off about it. And said, you know, how can you possibly have this on a Christian production? And Dallas Jenkins, who again, evangelical Christian, he said, well, yes, that you may disagree with that and all this sort of stuff, but in this context, I'm a boss, and it's not my place to tell people what to think when they're in the workplace, just in the same way that you wouldn't want an employer telling you couldn't wear a crucifix or a cross or anything like that. And it just seemed such a phenomenal example of leadership, which I don't think you would see from a more traditional funding model. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I'm just considering this, that because you've got people of a variety of faiths and none that are acting in this. Mm. It's such a faith-inspired piece of TV that it's not a non-religious person making a film about an interesting story. It is people with faith trying to make an authentic depiction of Jesus. But actually, you've got people of all faiths and none. It's sort of an interesting juxtaposition, that I would imagine.
There's no prerequisite for there to be faith to work on the thing, and I think that then means you put quality first, which is not something Christian media has been traditionally associated with, you know? And I think about, I can't believe it, but about 10 years ago now, we put on a few plays in church. I did a production of Much Ado and Inspector Calls and Twelfth Night and Alice in Wonderland, which nearly killed us.
Yes.
And it was church based, but the net that we cast for people to be in it was quite wide.
Mm.
And it worked well in the sense that it got non-Christian people just through the door of a church building and getting them to make friends with people who are Christians. So it's like, it's just a little step to be like, hey, we're not all total freaks, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Community outreach. Outreach,
yeah, definitely. I feel we've gone very far from Julia's point there. Do you want to take us to the next one?
Yeah. So Jonathan Rumi, who we know plays Jesus, actually met with Pope Francis during one of his general audiences in the Vatican City. When asked for a selfie, the Pope cheerfully accepted, saying that, quote, the Pope needs Jesus, which I thought was quite cute. And Dallas Jenkins was also there. And there's a great video of this kind of interaction where the Pope, he points to Jonathan and he goes, so if you're Jesus, does that mean you're Judas? As he points to Dallas. So Dallas kind of goes, no. I might not be Catholic, but which I thought was just a really cute interaction. And then my last one is, so we've, I think, already kind of mentioned how faithful, pun intended, that this show is to creating that environment of what it was like during Jesus's time. And the show actually has consultants from three major sects, including Catholicism, Evangelicalism, and then also, I think I'm pronouncing this correctly, Messianic Judaism, which from a little bit of research that I've done is kind of like, it's not quite Orthodox Jewishness, but it's a sect of Jewish people who follow Jesus as a Messiah.
Gosh, if anybody could tell us about Messianic Judaism.
If only there was someone who had a podcast that interviewed one.
then I will take it over to you, because I was reading this going, huh, for most of the time. So please do enlighten me.
I mean, essentially it's saying that Jesus did not come to start a new religion. He came to fulfill Judaism, not to start a new religion. So I did not come to replace the law, I came to fulfill it. So he came to fulfill the Jewish promise of Messiah. And so the intention wasn't for Judaism to end and Christianity to start, but for Judaism to be fulfilled and the Jewish people to follow the Messiah. Then politics got involved and created a kind of separate religion of Judaism. But there's a very small group of Messianic Jews who believe that Jesus is the Messiah, but continue to practice Judaism. So they do all the Jewish festivals and things like that.
Yeah.
That's it in a kind of simple nutshell.
Yeah.
Interesting. To a point. Yeah, a lot of what sense. I was kind of coming across during my research was things like, are Messianic Jews really Jews? How does this work with Christianity? It was quite confusing as a complete novice to
I think the reality is that Jews don't think they're Jews and Christians don't think they're Christians, so they get a little bit get a little bit of flack, bless them,
for either side, really.
The guy you interviewed had a little bit of edge to it, you know. It was a little bit like, Jesus is ours, we saw him first, you know. Do you remember the Goodness Gracious Me sketch where the granddad keeps claiming that everybody's Indian, including Father Christmas, you know? It sort of reminded me of that. Jesus, he's Jewish. He's nothing to do with you. He's Jewish. You're like, yeah, okay. All right, yeah, all right, fine. I'll be over here.
Continuing on this kind of vein. So Jonathan Rumi is Catholic, although he was born Greek Orthodox, which I think is an interesting kind of trajectory. And Dallas Jenkins describes himself as Protestant. So there's definitely a lot of different areas and different vibes going on, which I think is really cool.
That's nice.
I like that. I much prefer that to all be in one particular thing, you know?
Yeah, it must bring different perspectives, which is good.
Definitely.
And that's it. I'm out of facts.
Fantastic. Thank you for those, Julia. Now, This may shock you, but nobody invites us to press junkets at the moment. Not that we could go anywhere because of the consequences of our actions, but we do have a friend who does get invited to press junkets. I'm going to let him introduce himself.
Hi, my name's Andy Godfrey, and I'm a film critic for Sorted magazine. I work as a full-time evangelist in Milton Keynes, but films are a passion of mine, an absolute passion, and it's just a joy to write for Sorted and great to be on the podcast today.
Andy, thank you so much for coming back to join us. This is, I think, your third time. You're getting up there as one of our absolute top guests.
Well, I think we did Blade Runner and we did The Eyes of Tammy Faye, didn't we?
As Tammy Faye just dropped, yeah. So we're doing this. So you're well on your way to being one of our top contributors. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you for having me.
You actually interviewed a lot of the cast for The Chosen for season four coming up, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, we via Sorted, we got an invitation to the premiere. They had a big premiere in Leicester mm-hmm. Square where they showed episodes one and two of season four. And the next day there was a press junket. It was the first time I'd ever been to a press junket in my life. Incredibly oh, wow. posh hotel. In Piccadilly, and a lot of the actors were there. I think five of them were there. But I'd also previously interviewed the guy who plays James for Sorted mm-hmm. as well.
Hang on, Big James or Little James?
James, the brother of John.
Right, okay.
George Harrison, the actor. And we were a little bit naughty in Sorted in that we said George Harrison plays James, but to quote the other George Harrison, here comes the sun.
Fantastic. I think you interviewed the lady that plays Mary Magdalene as well, didn't you?
We did. Elizabeth Tabish. I interviewed her. Very lovely lady. It was a really interesting interview because I asked her if she felt there was justification for Mary Magdalene's reputation. Mm. Mary Magdalene has this reputation as being a bit of a bad girl. You know,
putting it delicately, yeah.
If you look in scripture, there's actually no reference to that whatsoever. And it was only a pope in a later century who declared Mary Magdalene to be a prostitute. So Elizabeth Tabish was really interesting because she said, I don't think Mary Magdalene deserves the reputation that she's got. Mm. She said, here's Jesus healing her of being demon possessed. And that was about the only thing that she knew about Mary Magdalene prior to filming The Chosen. Was interestingly that Mary was the one who was there at the tomb yeah. and met the risen Christ after on Easter Sunday. She said that was the only thing I knew about Mary Magdalene. She didn't know about her bad reputation. She didn't know about the fact Jesus had healed her from being demon possessed. And so she said that she was learning on the job about this character, but she felt that Mary does not deserve the bad rap that she's had over the years.
Yeah.
Because she was probably a lot more innocent. I asked her, you know, I pointed out that Jesus Christ Superstar portrays Mary Magdalene as being in love with Jesus. The song, I Don't Know How to mm-hmm. Love Him. I said to her, do you think that there was this possibility of Mary Magdalene being in love with Jesus, being physically in love, being romantically in love with Jesus? Mm-hmm. Of course, that's the whole basis of the Da Vinci Code, isn't
yeah.
it? Mary Magdalene got married and had kids. She said no. She said that she felt, given Mary's knowledge of who Jesus was, she would not have dared to get romantically involved with Jesus, knowing that Jesus was the Son of God. Mm. And how could she, as a mere woman, no matter how much she may actually have loved him, have actually got involved?
Yeah.
So her take on this business of Jesus and Mary Magdalene's relationship was, I don't think Mary would have gone down that road because it was a dangerous road and it was a road that was never going to lead to anything anyway.
Yeah, it's such...
Because of who Jesus was.
It's a role that's definitely got a lot of history to it now, hasn't it? There's been so many... She's such a key character that... you couldn't shop around and basically find your favourite depiction these days. And the one in The Chosen is definitely one of mine.
I think what I love about The Chosen, Giles, is that, you know, they've looked at the Bible. They're Christians on set. The director's a mm-hmm. Christian. Writers are Christians. And they've said, let's make the Bible just come alive without altering the story. Mm. Yeah, we'll put a bit of background in for some of the characters that that isn't in the Bible. But I mean, you take a film like Risen, which so vividly portrays the resurrection of Christ and so vividly explains the Christian message, is a story that isn't in the Bible. And why not do this? Why not create a bit, and if it gets people watching, if it gets people thinking, if it puts us back in Bible times and makes us sort of feel what they felt, see what they saw. And I'm very, very impressed, having been to Israel a couple of years ago, with the sets of The Chosen. So I think what they've done with Mary Magdalene is really, really good. And they have given her a lot more credit than I think a lot of other productions have for being a decent woman.
Definitely.
As opposed to someone who just want to portray her outright as a really bad, naughty girl, you know.
You saying naughty girl just sounds wrong on so many new and interesting levels.
It does sound wrong on so many levels, doesn't it? You know what I mean.
I do. Andy, thank you so much for talking to us today. It's been such a joy to have you on.
Thanks, Charles. Thanks for having me. God bless you.
Okay, everyone. That was Andy Godfrey. What did you think?
It's interesting that he was talking about Mary Magdalene because... my soon-to-be mother-in-law actually sort of subscribes to the theory that Mary and Magdalene and Jesus were actually married. And yeah, which her reasoning for that being that I believe Mary Magdalene is one of the people who like prepares Jesus's body for him to go into the tomb, which is obviously quite like an intimate thing to do. So at least how she briefly explained it to me is her sort of little theory or headcanon, I suppose. Is that maybe Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married, which is a bit Da Vinci Code, I think, as Andy mentioned.
It's massively Da Vinci Code. I mean, we are at some point in the future when we get time, we will probably do Da Vinci Code and just be like, it was completely pointless, but it's a lot of fun, you know.
This is just kind of a topic that you've done before, which is that some people can't believe that men and women can be platonically friends. Do you know what I mean? That if you have a close friendship with someone of the opposite sex, you have to marry them. And I think, you know, the reality is at the time of Jesus, it was really unusual for him to have a close friend that was a woman, and certainly to have women within his kind of closest group that he was teaching and things like that. So I think that it was probably just a shock. And so they wanted to find an explanation for it that wasn't quite as shocking.
Do you know what this is? I know this is off topic, but this does remind me so much of what Russell T. Davis said about like Rose and the Doctor. And he said, the thing is, you don't really have to work that hard at creating sexual tension between characters. You just put a man and woman on screen at the same time and you let the fans figure it out. You let them just do their own stuff. They will figure out on their own whether you like it or not, you know? So I think it just feels like we've had centuries of going, but she's a girl. She's a girl and Jesus likes her and they must have been married. I don't think it works like that, guys.
I know, I don't know if this is biblical or not, that she had a bit of money, so she supported a lot of the work that Jesus and his disciples were doing. And so people thought, she has money, there's only one way a girl can get money.
There's a few different theories surrounding Mary of Magdala. First of all, I think at this time in history, and in this particular culture, at least of a third of women probably had the name Mary.
I was going to say.
Mariam or Maria.
I think the part of the problem is that there's about 15 Marys, so no one can quite
or John. They're either Mary or John, that's it.
Yeah.
Exactly. So there's a lot to play for. I think possibly because, again, something that Andy mentioned about how some Pope at some point decided that Mary was the woman caught in adultery. And possibly the idea of Mary being a woman of property and a woman of money might be like an overcorrect, because it's not a great look that the one sort of named female follower of Jesus at this point is equated with being a prostitute when there's nothing that actually says that she was, you know? It's just, oh, look, there's a woman and there's another woman. Must be the same woman. So... we don't know. We do know in the book of Acts that there are women of means and women who are business
Yeah, I think there definitely were women that financially supported Jesus and the disciples, I think. I don't know any more than that, honestly. It's not something I know a great deal about.
I'm slightly disappointed she's not a prostitute. I quite like the idea that Jesus hung with the, you know, with the ladies of the night.
Well, he did.
We know that he did.
we know that he did that. And, good. Again, I thought it was an interesting choice in The Chosen to make of that. And the way that it kind of, there's a lot of intersecting identities going on there. Obviously, that she's just a woman in the first place. Then that she's been a prostitute. Then she's also a victim of sexual abuse.
Is that made specific though? That she's a prostitute. Is that made?
Yeah.
Am I just misremembering?
I think it's implied against her a few times, but not. I think not explicitly said.
I think it was implied, but not like
when she's referred to as Lilith in the first series, in the first few episodes. That's where it.
Yes,
where
but it's, isn't like. That's possessed by
a spirit, wasn't she? And Lilith is
Lilith is the name of a demon.
Yeah. It could be one of those things where because they're trying to appeal to a very specific audience, I would have to go back and listen to it line by line for it. But the impression I always got was that she was a prostitute. Hmm. It's entirely possible that it's just implied, and therefore you can read it. However you want.
For me, it was just implied and wasn't necessarily explicit.
I am going to go back to that first series and fact check this mercilessly.
Yeah.
And if you guys have got this wrong, the outside world will never know. This bit won't make it.
I didn't even know that she was possessed by demons. Like that was completely new for me. And I think what was really weird is seeing a demonic possession not in a horror film. So like when Nicodemus goes to see her in the Red Quarter and he's like, you know, be gone, foul demons, and the demons are like, nah mate, I'm gonna chill. That really took me off guard for a second, because I feel like you don't really see demonic possession in a lens of, yes, this is a not a normal, but like a thing that is happening, and we're not kind of intercutting it with like jump scares and like spooky lighting. It was really weird.
And I think partly it's that the Bible is sort of quite light and dainty sometimes, and it goes, oh, and there's a woman, and it, you know, there was demon to possess, and then Jesus said this and they disappeared. And it's quite a sort of 2D way of telling a story. Mm. So it doesn't feel scary until someone colours it in, and then you go, oh yeah, that's crazy.
I mean, you say the Bible's quite light and dainty. There's literally one scene in the Book of Judges where a woman rams a tent peg through a dude's head. Yeah. So,
sorry, I should just... Sorry, the Gospels, I think, sometimes.
Yeah.
I think that comes from it being in translation a lot of the time.
Mm.
I found that when reading some Homer and the Aeneid and stuff at university, when you read things in translation, you do lose quite a lot of the...
intensity, maybe.
Yeah, the feeling, the tone of it gets lost.
Yeah.
I'm going to jump in now because we're jumping in. And I'm just going to say, now it's time for... Finding the Faith in the Film.
We weren't sure how that was going to work with three of us, but it worked.
not rehearsed, if you can believe it, ladies and gents. For this, I thought I would pass it over to Mrs. Goff and see what she had to say.
Hello. Yeah, wonderful. So I really like the episode that covers Mary's crisis. Kind of crisis of confidence in herself more than anything else, I think, isn't it? I really like that it shows that following Jesus doesn't just magically fix all of your issues.
Mm.
And you might still need to go to therapy. Seriously, people, go to therapy.
You have Jesus and a therapist too.
Yes. Yeah. So some people have a conversion where they're miraculously cured of their drug addiction or whatever, but for most of us, you still have to do the work, actually. And, you know, if you've had a particularly traumatic past, that's probably not going to just disappear all by itself, and that's still going to affect you. And I think some people, when they become Christians, expect everything to be all kind of rosy and lovely, and then when it's not, it can be a bit of a shock. And I think that's kind of reflected really well in Mary's experience. And honestly, like, my mental health issues really started after I became a Christian. I don't think they're directly correlated. I think it was more to do with hitting puberty. I think there can be a false impression that being a Christian and following Jesus means that you won't ever have big problems or big mental health issues again, and that's just not true. And I really like that they portray that.
Yeah.
But also that they really care about her, and they really, and Jesus especially, really make the effort to go and get her back, you know.
Yeah, there seems, it's almost like no man left behind kind of policy. Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
And I thought it was fascinating, because this is one of those phrases that I've sort of known since being a teenager, but I don't think I've ever heard anyone say it in adult life. Have you ever heard the term backslide?
Oh, yeah.
Backsliding.
And I hate it. Yes.
Yeah, it's not a great term. How would you define it?
It's kind of used by a certain type of Christian to describe someone that's, I don't know if lost their faith, but not doing very well in their faith. It's a bit of a pejorative.
It can be a bit, can be used quite judgmentally, can't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. So it can be used for, like, you know, example, if someone's living with someone outside of marriage or something like that, it tends to be used sometimes in that context, I think. Or if someone's, I don't know, following a sort of theology that you don't agree with, I think it can be used in that kind of way.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously as a term, it can be sort of weaponized, but I think it wouldn't be unreasonable to describe what Mary kind of goes through in this season as that, because she has, it feels like she has a crisis of faith, and then she kind of goes back to what she knows to an extent. And I think the depiction of Mary is so nuanced and so much to it. There's almost a suggestion that alcoholism is part of it. And you'll appreciate this, Lou, because I keep thinking of the scene in The West Wing where Leo McGarry.
Oh, and the, okay, Leo, yeah.
It's the deposition one where he's being deposed and he's sort of chatting up his lawyer at the same time. And the way he talks about how when you first sort of try to get sober, people are there and they're supportive and they're there, they want to help you. And then when you fall off the wagon a second time and you fall back, people are like, get away from me. I don't want to know you, you know? And it's fascinating with this because it's not just her problem. It's like everybody's problem. Jesus literally sends like Matthew and Peter and Simon out to find her. And it becomes a priority. And I think that's the way we should look at just people who are having a crisis of faith, because those are painfully common, you know?
Definitely.
It's like the parable of the lost sheep, isn't it?
Yeah.
Definitely.
That actually, the shepherd will do everything he can to find that one lost sheep.
And I can imagine churches probably struggle with that, you know, if you have someone who has been an alcoholic or a drug addict or whatever, who becomes a Christian. Are you joining in, Cassidy? Thank you.
Yeah, what did you have to say, Cass? Any thoughts on the matter? Surprisingly quiet now. Huh. That's interesting.
I think it could probably be quite easy to not know how to deal with it if someone slips up and you know, drinks again.
I think it's almost a lack of understanding of what addiction is. Is that
definitely
somehow it's a choice?
Yeah,
and that actually they don't necessarily see it as a mental illness. Or they, I think there's some churches who may not see that mental health issues are compatible with Christianity. That if you know, your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit, if you're praying, if you're doing all this stuff, that actually you are somehow immune to mental health issues. And maybe that's just, you know, not judging at all, but just a lack of understanding of what addiction and mental health issues are.
Yeah, and I think there can be a bit of an attitude of, well, your faith's not strong enough if you're struggling with this kind of thing.
Is there biblical evidence of that she had an issue with alcohol? Was that just a bit of artistic license? No, it didn't.
Bit of artistic license. I think I remember what Sam Hales said about this show was like the key thing with it is credibility, you know, and like, could something have happened? Could this have happened? And I think that's good, because otherwise all you're going to get is a literal depiction of all the words, all the things presented in the gospel, you know. And it's fine, but it's a historical document. It's a very quite a dry historical document at some point. So if you imagine, let me think. So Mark is the oldest surviving gospel. You're going to like this, Julia, because apparently there is they call it like a theoretical Q document, a Quell, I think. I'm not sure if I'll have to, this is going back, where it's the idea that at some point there would have been a document of like Jesus's teachings and sayings that were all written down as they went along that has somehow been lost to history. And that's obviously literally you would write down the most important things that you that you're seeing, and it's Jesus says this, Jesus says that, and that's what we get. And as a result of that, we're always positioned to, how can I put this, see the apostles as kind of dumbasses, you know?
Yeah.
Like, if you grew up in on a planet where, at least in Western culture, has been informed by all of Jesus' teachings, then you take for granted, like, sort of blessed are the poor, that kind of thing. And it doesn't sound revolutionary. And one thing I think this show does an amazing job of is positioning you as the viewer in the apostles' position, and you're like, Rabbi, what did you mean by that? There's that lovely scene. Do you remember when John the Baptist, creepy John, turns
creepy
up?
Creepy John, you know? Yeah. I love that.
And he's like, I know you are who you say you are. When is stuff going to happen? And there's a brilliant bit where Jesus kind of says to him, look, I'm going to tell a lot of stories, and some people are going to get it and some people are not. And that's just the way it's going to be, yeah. You know?
I love that John's like, look, I trust your timing, but can you do this soon, please?
Yeah. Soon. Soon comes up so often.
Yeah, soon.
This nebulous and there's, soon. And there's,
yeah, and that the disciples are like, soon. Yeah, I've heard that word before. You know, they're quite so sarcastic with it. Yeah.
It's nice to see them have like senses of humor and to be able to joke and laugh. Yeah. Especially to have Jesus have that sense of humor. Like one bit that did have me fully cackling was, you know, when they helped the Samaritan. I think it might be in season one or possibly early season two. And he's just told this story about how he broke his leg because he'd beaten this Jew in the road to steal his horse and he left him for dead. It's really harrowing. Like, I'd done terrible things. And then when they get up to leave, Jesus is like, oh man, we should go soon. We don't want it to get too late because we don't know who might jump us on the road. Too soon? Just had me pure cackling. It was so good to see Jesus as like a very human individual, which I think really, really helps connect him, I think, with an audience.
That is such a gorgeous piece of storytelling, because obviously we think of the tale of the Good Samaritan as a parable. It is a parable, and Jesus is basically Dallas Jenkins and the producers are basically positioning it as this thing actually happened, and Jesus knew it happened. And who are we going to see it from their perspective? We're going to see it from the thief's perspective, you know? Speaking as somebody who occasionally creates a bit of Christian Bible fanfic, that was top shelf. That was top tier. Do you know what I mean? That was awesome. Do you have any other points you wanted to make, Darlene?
Yeah, I do think it's interesting seeing the tension and the bickering between the disciples. Because they must have fallen out with each other. They all came from very different backgrounds. They didn't all know each other beforehand, so you're sort of getting to know each other. And obviously you've got Matthew, who's the tax collector, and you've got people who are fishermen and people with very different views on things. And so I think that's really interesting. And it's like, you know, like we are in churches, we're falling out with each other is basically the church's thing. That's what we do. Yeah. is just disagree on stuff and then have big historical splits. The thing is, the difference for them is that they kind of knew a little bit, I don't know, did they know a little bit more that they were committed because they were actually there with Jesus, so maybe they could trust a little bit more in each other's authenticity, perhaps, than we can in a church necessarily, because you don't always know that people's motives are genuine, that they really believe what they're following, whereas I feel like they could believe that. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's like I think Jesus is sort of forcing, not forcing them, but helping them to overcome those differences between them. I think Matthew's especially interesting because it's almost, and I don't know if there's any evidence for this in the Bible, but the way that he's portrayed very much reminds me of a lot of students that I work with who are on the autism spectrum.
Yeah.
Props to the actor because he plays this very well as well, where it's not a caricature, I think, of how you would expect people on that spectrum to behave, but a very genuine, you know, doesn't quite understand metaphor has a very kind of pragmatic outlook on things and facts and figures and calculating the most logical way to do things, I think was a stroke of genius and actually really, really brought him to life as a person rather than some dude who wrote things down for Jesus. So
I think it was
a conscious decision play his character as someone that was on a spectrum.
Autistic Matthew has been one of the selling points from the beginning, because we don't have like a good representation of neurodivergent people in the Bible, because they just did not know how to diagnose that in the time, you know. That wraps up our Finding the Faith in the Film section. We have, okay, it's not strictly a review, but think of it as like review adjacent, okay? Rob Helms, who we've quoted before, we quoted him on the Tammy Faye episode, he said, "We really enjoyed the podcast, mate, on Tammy Faye. Me and my wife listened to it yesterday, and then we had to watch the movie too, which was also really good." And that's interesting, because I think that's got to be the first time somebody's listened to the podcast first and then found the film.
Yeah.
So I thought that was fascinating.
It's nice.
Okay, ladies and gents, I hope you've enjoyed this Easter special on The Chosen Season 2. And we hope to see you at some point in the future. Ladies, have you had a good time?
I always have a great time. Always. You know that, darling.
Fantastic.
Absolutely, I have. Thank you, Giles, for inviting me back.
It sounds so much creepier when there's three women that I'm asking that question to. Okay, ladies and gents, if you have been, thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye! Bye.
God in Film is hosted and created by Giles Goff.
That's me.
Mixing and editing by Giles. Our logo was designed by
Julie Walsh.
And our theme tune was composed by
Rick Lee.
Waffle editing by
Natalie Minica.
Please rate and review.
Please give us 5 stars, because that's a nice thing to do.